Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. My mental health really began to suffer during COVID. At first, life seemed normal. I work from home anyway. But as the months passed, with no vacation, no friends to see, no change in routine, it was a bit like the walls were closing in. And one of the things that got me through that period was therapy. Talking to someone who could help change the patterns that led to distress was incredibly helpful. If there's something you need to get off your chest, then why not give BetterHelp a try? You can just fill out a brief questionnaire online and they'll match you with a licensed therapist. You can arrange things to suit your schedule, and if you don't click with the person you're talking to, it's easy to switch to someone else. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Byzantium today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp. HELP.com/Byzantium. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History of Byzantium, episode 271, Twilight Cities, with Catherine Pangonis. Today is an interview with author Catherine Pangonis about her new book, Twilight Cities, Lost Capitals of the Mediterranean. You may remember Catherine from episode 238, where we spoke about her previous book, Queens of Jerusalem. She also returned to talk about the devastating earthquakes that hit Turkey in February 2023. In Twilight Cities, she travels to Tyre, Carthage, Syracuse, Ravenna, and Antioch to tell the stories of these forgotten capitals and to experience what remains today. This book is something I think you'll all be interested in. The history of these places is so fascinating, and Catherine takes you through their heyday, pre the takeover by Rome and then Constantinople. But then she rolls into the Roman, Byzantine, Islamic, and Crusader eras. So you get a whole potted history of the place. And if, like me, you dream about Mediterranean holidays, where you could actually visit some of the places from your history books, then this is definitely for you. Your standard guidebook won't tell you where to find the ruins, the lost treasures, and the hills where heroes once stood. So thank God Catherine is here to help. In the interview, I ask her to skip the stuff that we know well, which she does cover in the book, and instead to tell us about the things that are less familiar, and also to talk about what you can see today. Here's the interview. Catherine Pangonis, welcome back to the History of Byzantium.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
I'm excited to talk to you because this book is right up my street. And reading it, it just made me think that I am one of those people who, if something exciting happened in a spot around the Mediterranean, I am excited to be there, even if there's just a pile of rubble left. And I get the sense that you are the same. So I will be asking you all about what is left in these lost capitals of the Mediterranean. Because that's what we're here to talk about, your book, Twilight Cities. Tell the listeners why you decided to write this book.
Oh, well, thank you. That is a good question. Why did I decide to write this book? I mean, the short answer is that my publishers made me. But the long answer is quite long. But it started years ago, just when I'd finished my undergraduate degree. And I went sailing with some friends in Sicily. And we got caught in a really awful storm because my friend who was skippering was a bit negligent, and we all went to sleep on the boat a bit tipsy and then woke up to sort of hurricane force winds. Very much, we're in the Aeolian Islands, so it's very much the fury of Aeolus. and our engine broke. The main, you know, the we lost both our anchor chains snapped. We had to
Oh,
do a main
God.
Recall. And we ended up having to stop in Syracuse on the southeast coast of Sicily for at least 24 hours. I think maybe, you know, at least 24 hours while some urgent repairs were made and we replaced the anchor chain and all this stuff. And I'd never even heard of Syracuse. And this was what really shocked me. You know, I was really passionate about history. And we just stopped in this Mediterranean city, which I knew, I didn't expect anything of it. And I just sort of was trying to get away from really irritating crewmates. I was, you know, we'd just been through a crisis together. They were all very annoying. And just walking around the city by myself, I was just blown away by all the different eras and regimes you could see written in the architecture of the city, you know, from class, you know, from, I mean, the Duomo of Syracuse in particular is such an interesting building because it was originally built as a temple of Athena. And so you stood by the original Corinthian settlers who founded the Greek city of Syracuse in Sicily. And so you see these amazing Doric columns still visible in the walls of this cathedral because they just built the cathedral around the remains of the ancient temple. And so it's been a place of worship pretty much continuously for 2,000, 3,000 years. And it's just so there's, so I was really blown away by this. And the city, you know, has as many layers of history as Rome, and they're evident everywhere, but with far fewer tourists. And I was sort of, how has the city escaped my notice? How have I not come across this city in my studies? This is just such a gap. So that's sort of where that idea started. And that actually was what led me to do my master's in sort of Mediterranean, Middle Eastern history, that experience. And then years later, I was researching my first book, Queens of Jerusalem, which you kindly had me on to discuss previously. And in the course of researching that book, I had a similar experience with two other cities that I visited, which were Tyre and Antioch. And obviously I'd heard of these places, you know, I visited them for research because I'd read about them. But again, in Tyre and Antioch, I was again blown away by these layers upon layers of history and just the sense of this lingering legacy of greatness, but that has been completely eroded. And we never think about. So, you know, I never studied, you know, Hellenistic or Roman Antioch, you know, it never came up really. And the same for Tyre, like you sort of heard of Tyre, especially people, Christians or Jewish people who are familiar with the Old Testament, you'll hear mentions of Tyre, you know, scattered throughout the Old Testament and all, you know, ancient chronicles and, you know, classical literature. But you don't really know much about it. And then you go to this place and you realize that you're actually standing in one of the remains of one of the great metropolises of antiquity. And it's just like, wow, you know, and why haven't we learned more about this? I wanted to learn more. And for each of these places, there's no real sort of accessible history of them. Syracuse is a bit different. There are a couple of books that deal with the history of Syracuse. But for Tyre and Antioch, actually getting to the history was quite tough. And I just thought, and I spoke to my publishers about this. I originally said I wanted to do a book on Syracuse, actually. And then I mentioned these other two places and they said, well, can you bring them together with some other cities and do this sort of book? And it actually came together really well because each of these cities sort of had its apogee, its sort of golden age in different periods. So in the end, what this book became or tried to become was a sort of alternative history of the Mediterranean, but through the lens of these less well-known capitals. And I hope I pulled it off, but that was the intention. And also I just wanted an excuse to spend 2 or 3 years hanging out in beautiful forgotten places around the Mediterranean, which was a total joy, I have to say. So yeah, that's why, and that's what the aim was.
That's what I loved about the book was the combination of the history with what it's like to be there now, and the travel aspect of it. And I think listeners to this podcast will, it'll chime with them because Rome and then Constantinople just kind of take over the world. But we all know the stories before they became preeminent were filled with Mediterranean city-states, you know, fighting with each other. So let's go through these cities and just talk about them a little bit. We'll go in the order they come in the book. So Tyre, which is in modern Lebanon, is the first city. And in not too long ago in the podcast, we were there with the Third Crusade. It was the one seaport which the Crusaders hung on to when Saladin swept them out of Jerusalem. And I suspect most listeners will remember Tyre holding up Alexander the Great long, long before that. So hopefully that's reminded people of Tyre. But when would you say Tyre's golden age was?
So generally speaking, Tyre's golden age is in the Bronze Age, sort of 916. People will say the golden age of Tyre was under the reign of King Hiram, a Phoenician king, so 969 to 32 BC. And Hiram is a contemporary of Solomon. And it's, you know, there's these sort of famous anecdotes that Hiram and Solomon were sort of pen pals who exchanged puzzles and had little logic contests, which Solomon tended to win, I think. But I'd really love to know more about those, but they're just fleeting references. And yes, again, Hiram and Solomon, they were contemporaries and they helped each other out. And Hiram sent Phoenician master craftsmen to build Solomon's temple in Jerusalem. So it's that sort of biblical period in the Bronze Age. And I have a real soft spot for Tyre. It's one of my favorite cities that I wrote about because I've been living in Lebanon for the past 2.5 years. And Tyre is just my favorite place. And I've spent, of all the cities that I wrote about in this book, I've spent the most time there. And it is amazing because you've mentioned Alexander's siege. Tyre started, so in the ancient times when Hiram was king, Tyre was an island city off the coast of Lebanon. And there are all these ancient sources that refer, you know, from the, I think, the Anastasi Papyrus, Amarna tablets, and later Roman sources who write about Tyre as a city in the sea and describe these amazing white walls of stone rising directly out of the waves. Apparently it really was one of the most stunning places in antiquity. It took the breath away from travelers and chroniclers who went there. And it was so beautiful and so famous in ancient times that actually Herodotus went as a tourist, if you like. He traveled from Halicarnassus to Tyre in Phoenicia, he says, on the Levantine coast, a Phoenician city that was famed for its Temple of Heracles. And the Temple of Heracles is actually the Temple of Melkart. Melkart was the patron god of Tyre, the patron deity of the city, and mythologically the founder of the city. And he becomes conflated with Heracles and sort of the Hellenistic world and Roman culture. So we sort of call him Heracles hyphen Melkart, and sometimes Heracles refers to Melkart, sometimes not. And the temple that Herodotus visited and wrote about, he describes as being sort of a wondrous beauty with this, you know, amazingly ornate decorations, and already 2,300 years old by the time that Herodotus visits it. And he describes these two columns in the center of the temple, one made of pure gold and one made of emerald that sort of glows in the darkness. So this is the sort of wealth of Tyre that we're talking about during its golden age, during its antiquity. It became incredibly wealthy as the city that traded, that built. They were master shipbuilders, and they had access to cedar wood from Mount Lebanon, which is brilliant wood for boats. And they built the navies for Egypt and other empires. They were the master seafarers, master navigators. They created the trade routes across the Mediterranean, founding trading colonies across the basin, including Carthage, which we'll come to. And they also traded in purple dye. You know, they boiled down these murex sea snail shells to extract this really rich purple color that would be used for the robes of emperors for generations to come. You know, we think of Theodora and Justinian in Ravenna and San Vitale wearing these purple robes. That this color came from Tyre. So it's this phenomenally wealthy Phoenician city-state that is conquered many times over the years, and eventually by Alexander, who, as you've mentioned, it holds him up for a while, and he ends up constructing a land bridge between the mainland and the island to march his troops over. And that land bridge never eroded, and ever since Alexander's siege, Tyre has been connected to the mainland on this sort of, you know, by this isthmus, and it's now a peninsula rather than an island. And it's an amazingly beautiful place. Even though it's now connected, you still have this feeling of being surrounded by the sea when you're there. And there's just antiquity everywhere. You know, it's not curated. It's not, you know, there are some archaeological sites that are well taken care of, but others aren't. And you can just be walking around the coast and you'll see a Roman column sticking up out of the sea. It's amazing. Just the amount of history that's there. You can really feel it as you walk around. It's one of my favorite places on earth.
Well, that was possibly the most interesting thing in the book in terms of modern travel, the idea that you can go swimming and diving and see if you can find anything from the ancient past on the seabed.
Yeah, and you can. I mean, you have to throw it back, of course. But, you know, even just if you go out for a swim with some goggles, you'll find the handle of an amphora just buried in the sand, because much of Tyre's archaeology is under the water. And actually, it's British archaeologists that are, or British archaeological foundations that are continuing many of these underwater excavations. But this area of coastline, both Israel, both Lebanon and further south in Israel, there's so much history off the coast. Like, one of the big discoveries in archaeology last year, I think, that made headlines, was someone just found a Crusader sword sticking out of the seabed just off the coast of Israel near Acre, which is just a stone's throw from Tyre. So there is just so much history, so easily accessible and visible off this bit of coast. It's really incredible.
And so if someone was going to visit Tyre tomorrow, what would you recommend they do?
Oh, well, I mean, mainly just walk around the Sea Road, because that's stunning. But from a historical perspective, there are two brilliant archaeological sites in Tyre, the Al Minna archaeological site and the Hippodrome. These two, they're sprawling, so it takes some time and wear a hat. But it's got one of the remains of one of the biggest hippodromes of the ancient world, the Roman Hippodrome in the southern archaeological site, which is adjacent to a Phoenician necropolis with also Roman and Greek tombs. So you can really see the developments and the successive cultures that have lived in Tyre over the years in that site. But also at the Al Minna archaeological site, it's just beautiful. It's right on the sea, and you have this great white Roman road with columns alongside it, like a colonnaded street leading out to the sea, and it's stunning. And then you also have, you know, there's a square sort of sunken arena, which archaeologists think may have been used to sort of, they may have filled it up with water and reenacted sea battles there. So that's fascinating. And you have sort of the remains of Roman sort of glass furnaces as well in that site. So there's so many layers there. But more interestingly, actually, is the archaeological site that isn't yet sort of curated and open to the public, because there are ongoing archaeological excavations in Tyre. And one of the most recent, and right next to the Crusader Cathedral, actually. So the reason I went to Tyre was to see what was left of William of Tyre's cathedral in Tyre. And there's you can definitely make out the floor plan, and there are columns still raised there. It's very interesting. And it's very atmospheric, I like to imagine. And William of Tyre is in there somewhere under all that mess. But immediately adjacent, there's this new excavation going on led by universities of Warsaw and Barcelona to excavate. They found a new Roman temple, essentially. And they haven't found an inscription or anything, but all the clues are pointing to that maybe it's the temple of Melkart, of Heracles Melkart, because it's a temple dating from the Roman times, but built in a Canaanite Phoenician style with a sort of subterranean tomb, which may be used for the ritual of the Agesis of Melkart. So it's so interesting. And that's history and archaeology really as it's happening, you know, every summer the archaeologists are back there. And that new discoveries are being made all the time, so it's really interesting.
It sounds it makes me excited to visit more places, and Tyre just sounds particularly rich. So you've already kind of told the story that obviously Phoenician traders are the ones who founded Carthage, which is the next city in the book and is obviously very familiar to listeners of this podcast. The inveterate enemy of Rome during the Republican period, and then visited by Belisarius during Justinian's reconquest. I was also amused to read that in 1985, the mayors of Carthage and Rome finally signed a peace treaty, ending the Third Punic War.
Yeah, it was never formally ended until the 20th century. So on it raged, yeah.
I really like that detail. But when would you say Carthage's heyday was what we would think of it, the Roman period?
I mean, yeah, sort of 4th century BC, when it is one of the largest metropolises in the world, and it's ruling and expanding the Carthaginian Empire, which dominated, you know, central Mediterranean, and as we know, was a major rival of Rome. So that's really the golden age for Carthage.
But why don't you tell the listeners something they won't know about Carthage to get them to check out the book?
Well, you have really educated listeners, so I'm not going to presume what they do and don't know, but I won't talk to you about the Punic Wars because I'm sure that's been well trodden. What I did try to do in my book is look less at the campaigns in Italy and Sicily, and my put greater because my book is about Carthage. I mean, this section's about the city of Carthage itself. So when I do talk about the Punic Wars, I actually give more attention perhaps than usual to the periods in between the wars. And to the wars on Carthaginian soil rather than focusing so much on the great victories in Italy and the battle for Sicily. But obviously that's important. I do bring that in. I think, you know, things that interested me a lot in the history of Carthage. Well, I mean, and also in the modern day, I mean, the Barbary Wars around Tunis, fascinating. But going further back, because that's really my milieu, I was very interested in the foundation myths of Carthage. We all know about Dido, Dido and Aeneas of Virgil and Virgil fame. But I was interested in unpacking the myth of Dido and learning the other perspectives, because there are other versions of this narrative which don't end with Aeneas rocking up in Carthage and then seducing Dido and then swanning off to found Rome, leading her to kill herself. The story of Dido, of Alyssa, the Phoenician name, coming to found Carthage, is I think more interesting through the other versions, in which Aeneas doesn't feature at all. You know, this is part of the Roman propaganda and building this myth of ancient enmity between Carthage and Rome. But in the other version of the myth, Alyssa does still kill herself by self-immolation. She still throws herself on the funeral pyre, but instead it's actually to avoid being forced to marry a North African lord that she doesn't want to marry, because she's so dedicated to the legacy of her and the memory of her dead husband. So I mean, in brief, you know, Alyssa fled Tyre because her twin brother assassinated her husband and was trying to steal his wealth, and Dido wasn't safe either. Dido is the name she's given later. It means wanderer, but her original Phoenician name is Alyssa. So Alyssa did not believe she was safe in Tyre, put to sea with some loyal comrades, picked up some women in Cyprus, whether voluntarily or not, it's not clear, and then made this new colony on the shore of North Africa. And this is, of course, a myth, but it's certainly true that Carthage was founded by Phoenician settlers. So I sort of examine those foundation myths and different reasons and elements of them. But then also, what I think is very interesting is that for many people, who especially those who consider Carthage through the lens of Roman history, many people believe that, you know, you hear the myth of the salt, the plains of Carthage being sown with salt to stop anything growing again. That's a complete fabrication. And many people believe that the history of Carthage ends with the complete destruction of the city by Rome at the end of the Third Punic War. But this is not the case. You know, the strategic location of Carthage, slightly off-center in the Mediterranean, and with this perfect positioning to control trade both east to west and north to south, Rome couldn't just abandon that location and let it become an overgrown pile of stones. It was a very important strategic location. So actually, not so long after the destruction of Carthage, it was refounded as a Roman colony and had the second life as an important Roman centre in North Africa and as a very important centre of early Christianity. So, I mean, the stories that I found very interesting were the stories of St. Perpetua and Felicity in Carthage. You know, St. Perpetua is a Roman girl born towards, I think she's born in something like 182 AD. And she comes of age, you know, probably, you know, 210 AD, something like that. I'm a bit hazy on precise dates, but it's around then. And she's asked to make a sacrifice to the emperor at the time, who is Septimus Severus, and she refuses on the grounds that she's converted to Christianity. The only person in her family, she's married with a child, her husband is a pagan, her family are pagans, but she's converted to Christianity. And she won't make the sacrifice, and she's imprisoned to await trial and execution. And what's remarkable is that while she's imprisoned, she writes a diary that survives, you know, that we still have the content of. It survived in copies down the generations. And it's a really human piece of literature. You know, she talks about the horrible conditions in the prison, feeling afraid. She talks about her faith. She talks about, you know, her breasts hurting because she's been separated from her infant child and she can't breastfeed. And it's really fascinating as a piece of literature and an insight into the life and education of a woman in a North African Roman city. And it's a really moving story. And then eventually she is thrown to the beasts in the arena. And you can still visit that Roman amphitheater now where St. Perpetua and St. Felicity, alongside the other martyrs, were killed that day. So it's really interesting. And then additionally, looking at early Christianity in Carthage, you know, St. Augustine was there, And he actually, you know, when you think about the Christianization of the Roman world and the violence of it, you know, we have St. Augustine actively preaching for the Christians in Carthage to rise up and destroy the pagan temples. And then we have great quotes from letters from St. Augustine sort of saying, oh, where is the power of Celestis now? Where is the power of Saturn now? You know, Christianity has triumphed. And they had, because Carthage retained very strong links to Tyre over the centuries and the ancient Phoenician gods, they have this temple dedicated to Heracles Melkart with this statue with a golden beard. And every year there's this ceremony where they regild the beard of this god. And under St. Augustine, they go and they shave the statue and hack off this golden beard to sort of humiliate the pagan community. So it's a very interesting place for studies of early Christianity. And yeah, just it's had a long afterlife after the Punic Wars, is what I would say.
Yeah, it's such an interesting history, religiously, going from, you discussed pagan sacrifice, and then the Roman era, and then the Christian era, and then the Muslim era, and so on.
And they fight over the, you know, and this is still politicized, because in Carthage, one of the few remaining sites from the Punic period, is the Tophet of Carthage, this essentially a graveyard for very young babies. And it's hotly debated whether this burial ground is evidence of widespread practice of child sacrifice, or whether it's just a graveyard for premature and stillborn children. I'm inclined towards the former, but it has become politicized, this debate, whether, you know, either way. So it's really interesting, and there are new discoveries and new questions being raised all the time.
Absolutely. So if someone visits today, what would you recommend they go and see?
Oh, there's so much to see in Carthage. I'm glad you've said this, because a friend of mine who used to live in Tunis, I went to Carthage once and there was nothing there, it's just old rocks. It's like, well, there are a lot of old rocks, I will say that, but the archaeological sites are very impressive. You know, we have Rome, but they are mostly Roman, is what I would say. Very little has survived from Punic Carthage as archaeological sites. But obviously there are many artifacts in the museum on Bursa Hill. Bursa Hill is where you must visit. This is, I mean, in the ancient foundation myth, this is the ancient center of Carthage that Dido claimed with her ox hide to make the center of her city. And so it's a hill, as the name suggests. And now it has a Christian cathedral on the top and the tomb of St. Louis VII, ill-fated crusader, etc. and so on, died in Tunisia. But this was the ancient center of Roman and Punic Carthage. So, and it's just, the views are incredible. So that's the first thing. But then around Bursa Hill, around the ancient sites of Carthage, you have the Antonine Baths, which I think is some of the most impressive Roman bath complexes, one of the most impressive Roman bath complexes remaining in the world. You have the remains of Roman villas. You have the amphitheater where St. Perpetua was killed. There are many sites around Carthage. And the Tophet. The Tophet is perhaps the most mysterious and interesting. And it's a strong link with the Punic past. So that's interesting.
Fantastic. Well, let's move on to Syracuse, where your journey began. And I believe you're going back there soon to talk about the book. So Syracuse has played a part in Byzantine history, but Southern Italy and Sicily is always a bit of a side story for the Byzantines, but it has come up enough. People know where it is. People know Belisarius capturing Sicily. But talk about Syracuse's heyday, which was, I suspect, before that.
Yeah, it was. But you really must do an episode on Euphemius in Syracuse. That's a great little Byzantine anecdote that you definitely need to share with your listeners, because it's really rich and it's very exciting. And it involves, I think, a Byzantine governor eloping or kidnapping a nun, and then, you know, it all kicks off with Euphemius. But Syracuse's heyday is long before that, alas, alack. It's sort of roughly 3rd century BC. So, you know, we usually say that the golden age of Syracuse, it was sort of the most populous Greek city in the world around sort of 250 BC. That's around when Archimedes is from Syracuse. So it has various periods of power and cultural flourishing. So Agathocles of Syracuse is a tyrant who takes, you know, he captures a lot of Italy and North Africa. He's an incredibly strong military ruler. So they're in, and Gelon, the first tyrant of Syracuse, also You know, you could argue that's the golden age of the city, but really for me, one of the most interesting times is Syracuse under the ruler Hieron II, who is this great patron of arts and sciences and supports Archimedes' early career and encourages him to turn from sort of theoretical studies to practical studies, sort of using his great mind for sort of defense and engineering rather than just for mathematical theories. And he's depicted, and the Indiana Jones franchise agrees with me, this is the most interesting part of Syracuse's history. The new Indiana Jones film is very Archimedes and Syracuse focused. And no spoilers, but the Roman siege of Syracuse plays a good role in that film. I was surprising watching. I enjoyed it. But yeah, the Golden Age, there are many, and also Plato was in Syracuse. So Syracuse is the place where Plato tried to trot out his idea of the philosopher king. He tried to educate the tyrants of Syracuse in the tenets of philosophy to try and create sort of these really just rulers, these philosopher kings, with very limited success, very limited success. And people have also argued that it's where Plato was inspired for the allegory of the cave, because in Syracuse, they have the sort of evil tradition of keeping their prisoners in their cave complexes where they'd be chained up and they would just see the shadows on the outside as their only glimpse of light in the outside world. So it's really interesting in this as a city of ideas and inspiration. But yeah, really, I mean, I talk about Archimedes and his inventions. So when you have the Roman siege of Syracuse, which I'm sure your listeners have come across, you have these myths of Archimedes' great heat ray burning Roman vessels out of the water by sort of using mirrors and magnifying lenses to use the power of the sun to burn ships out of the water. The great grappling claw that could theoretically lift triremes right out of the waves. This is all really interesting. And this has not been definitively proven, but it is a time of brilliance in Syracuse because, you know, Archimedes' screw, it's sort of like a hydraulic screw system which can draw water up a tube. That was a very important invention for agriculture and engineering. Then we have his other inventions. So we have the, you know, the Syracusia. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. Your Greek listeners, I really apologize, but Archimedes developed one of the biggest ships, the biggest trade ships of antiquity, with sort of a marble temple within. It's sort of like the Titanic luxury yacht of the ancient world, and was so brilliant and did not sink, but he got his calculations slightly off in that while he created this amazing trade ship that could travel across the Mediterranean, it was so big that there were only two harbours in the entire Mediterranean big enough to accommodate it. So it could really only ever go between Syracuse and Alexandria. And on its first voyage from Syracuse to Alexandria, Ptolemy, the pharaoh in Egypt at this time, decides he didn't want to let it sail back to Syracuse and hauled it out of the water and use it as like a palace slash museum. So it only sailed once, but it's this time of invention and cultural flourishing in when Syracuse is probably at its most powerful, most wealthy in the lead up to the Roman sack of Syracuse, which eventually unfortunately ends in the death of Archimedes sort of inadvertently by a rogue Roman soldier. But yeah, really interesting place.
Yeah, it's amazing how it's just each of these places is involved in kind of all the big stories of the ancient and medieval worlds. And obviously Syracuse is involved in the great wars between Athens and Sparta and Peloponnesian Wars and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the defining moment of the Peloponnesian Wars was in the harbour of Syracuse, not in Athens or Sparta. You know, it's the destruction of this Athenian fleet in Syracuse that really paved the way for the decline of Athens in the Mediterranean. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And in terms of places to visit today, you talk about going to see performances of Greek tragedies in the theatre there.
Yes, the legacy lives on. I mean, the Greek theatre in Syracuse, I think, is probably the best preserved Greek theatre in the world. It's in amazing condition and it's huge and impressive and it's beautiful. And beyond that, yes, they do revivals of the Greek tragedies every year, every summer. So I've seen you know, the Bacchanalia. I've seen a lot there, but it's a stunning experience. It really comes to life and they really respect the tradition there. And then in terms of what else to visit, the Ear of Dionysius, again, now of Indiana Jones fame. But this is this amazing cave where, you know, myth has it that this is where the Athenian prisoners were held after. I mean, it's possible there are two cave complexes and it could be the Latomi as well. But the Ear of Dionysius is called this because, you know, according to myth, legend, the Athenian prisoners were kept in the back of the cave and the acoustics in it meant that anything they were saying could be heard by the guards. because it echoes round this sort of amazing bend in the cave, and you can, if you whisper at the very back, you can hear it like a shout at the front. So it's, and it's just, it's beautiful, and again it has this amazing atmosphere of history. You can, you very much feel like you're standing in an ancient place. It's very, it's moving, I would say. Yeah,
fantastic. Well, I'm sure we could talk about Syracuse lots more, but let's move on. I feel people will travel to Italy and Sicily, so it needs less selling from us. The next capital further north is Ravenna. Very familiar to listeners of the History of Byzantium and the History of Rome. Was obviously the Roman imperial capital as the empire that began to stumble. Would that be Ravenna's heyday?
Yeah, I mean, I love how you say began to stumble. yeah, so I mean, Ravenna's heyday is between the 5th and 8th centuries. When Honorius moves the capital there, the era of Galla Placidia, hugely important. Of course, Byzantine reconquest, Belisarius, Justinian, Theodora, these amazing proliferation of early Christian art, mosaics across the city is beautiful. And then also under Theodoric, you know, and, you know, it's very, yeah, it's, it retains a lot of importance throughout that period. But I then, you know, so that's all very interesting. And that's, I think that's all very familiar to your listeners. So I won't talk too much about that. But what I do try to shine a light on is, again, the afterlife of Ravenna. It's the continuation of its history in later centuries. So the Battle of Ravenna, for one, Gaston of Foix, but also, again, looking at it as a cultural centre. You know, it's where Dante spent his final years composing Paradiso. It's where Byron had his, you know, spent his last time before the Greek Wars of Independence, where he died, had his last great love affair with the Countess Guiccioli, and composed a lot of Don Juan and other amazing poetry. And the art in Ravenna has inspired artists and writers and philosophers down the generations. So, you know, Klimt was inspired for his golden period by the art in Ravenna. And I think it was Jung. Yeah, Jung went there and was so moved by the mosaics that it left him having hallucinations. And he gave lectures to his students about mosaics in Ravenna that people then went to find and found they didn't exist. He'd been so sort of swept up in the beauty of the place that he had these hallucinations that he truly believed were real. So it's a fascinating city that has continued as a cultural centre for years following. And, you know, it's important not just for its Byzantine heyday, but also, yeah, in later centuries as well. And it's a very historically rich city. And I really recommend listeners visit, because it's very easy to visit, and you will not be disappointed. In fact, you'll be pleasantly surprised, because it's a city that has a very quiet exterior. You know, modest red brick buildings could, you know, when you walk through the centre, you know, it could be any city in northern Italy. And then you enter these buildings and there's this golden history written across the ceilings. And it's incredible. Yeah.
Well, I started this by saying you and I were the kind of people who could look at a few stones on the ground and talk about how great it was to be in a place. Having done some tours around Turkey, I know that not everyone feels that way. Some people want buildings to still stand and
they want look, play.
Yeah, look like they did. Exactly. So of all these capitals, would you say Ravenna is the one with the sort of most complete looking historical buildings?
It would be between Ravenna and Syracuse, because Syracuse, the Greek remains are great. And the, like I say, the era of Dionysius is just very impressive. And there's, and just, and Sicily is, you know, Syracuse is just beautiful. So Sicily, I'd say there's more, the scale in Syracuse is greater in terms of the Greek theatre is huge. The cave systems are very interesting. There are Greek tunnels under the city. There's the castle of Euryalus just outside, an ancient Greek fortress. Syracuse has good ruins in good nick. But Ravenna, it's the art. So yes, we still have these amazing buildings from the Byzantine period. And in terms of for intricate beauty, there's nothing to rival them. I mean, the mausoleum of Galla Placidia, it's not where she's actually buried, but that is just stunning. It will take your breath away. And, you know, it's still in as brilliant condition as it was in ancient times, well, late ancient times. And the sophistication of it, it's just beautiful. Like, I'm trying to think, you know, you couldn't do better in the modern day, really. It's just stunning. So, yes, if you want to really see the grandeur of Byzantine art. I don't think there's any better place to see it than in Ravenna. Yeah.
Yeah. And just in case anyone has forgotten, that is where you can see Justinian and Theodora.
Yeah, Theodora with her girl squad and decked out in all their imperial finery. Yeah, it's really stunning.
Fantastic. Well, that brings us to the final city, and for good reasons and very, very sad reasons, it's familiar. It's Antioch, which has obviously played a massive role in Byzantine history and Crusader history, and of course, tragically, has been flattened again by an earthquake. And listeners can go and listen to our episode on that if they want to donate to the relief effort. When is Antioch's heyday? That, I imagine that one was difficult to choose.
That one is difficult to choose. I mean, you could either, you know, its period as the capital of Seleucid Empire is obviously a strong contender, but also, you know, as a Greek city, you know, so in this Greek period, but then also as the capital of sort of Roman Syria, it's also incredibly important. And you have emperors holidaying there. You know, we talked about that's a complete unfair statement. And in our episode on the earthquake, we talked about, you know, Trajan living there when an earthquake struck and having to escape out the window. Other emperors very much held court there. It was a very important center. And then again, as discussed, I mean, this is actually what drew me to the podcast, Robin. I was researching Antioch and I discovered your podcast on the sea, your extended podcast on the sea of Antioch. And it's what got me listening and got us in touch. And so, yeah, again, becomes, you know, a very important frontier Crusader principality in the high Middle Ages. So it has arguably has three golden ages that each extend a couple of centuries in some cases. So it's really hard to pin that down. But as I say, a city rich for layers of history.
Absolutely. Can you tell the listeners something they won't know from the pre-Roman period?
Okay, well, again, Antioch is a city that's been well covered in your podcast and others, so I'm sure listeners are familiar with a lot of its history. But one fun fact I came across while researching was that according to Libanius, a great orator who wrote a lot, who was a native of Antioch and wrote a lot about the city and gave very good descriptions of it, so we can help us visualize the city at that time. He also wrote about the foundation of the city and the planning of the city. And he said that the way that Seleucus planned the city that was named in honor of his father, Antiochus, was he stationed his war elephants around the edges of where he wanted the city to be built and just told the builders, right, wherever there's an elephant, build a tower there. So I liked that the elephant played a key part in the urban planning of Antioch. But I think one of the things that I found most interesting about Antioch in all its iterations, it's just how diverse the city has always been. So, you know, it was founded by Seleucus Nicator following Alexander's conquests. And when it was the original inhabitants of the city were, yes, a large amount of Macedonians from Seleucus's army, but also, you know, it's also recorded that among the armies and the people who settled there were Cypriots, Cretans, and Argives, many native Syrians, but also Athenians and Jewish settlers. And they established their own communities. So it was always a multicultural and multilingual city. And this has carried on down the centuries. I mean, sometimes it's hard to find, but, you know, I was looking at sort of 18th century, 19th century travel writing from people who went to Antioch. And we have these really interesting descriptions of being hosted by people from different communities. So even in Ottoman Antioch, you have quite a wealthy Christian community in Antioch. And that's continued to today. I mean, no longer today, until prior to the February 6th earthquakes, which have changed everything. But there was still a Jewish community in that city that dated back thousands of years to the city's foundation. I think there were 12 or 15 Jewish families or Jewish people remaining in Antioch today, but there was still a functioning synagogue that was very much part of the community. And likewise, the Greek Orthodox Church had a large community, major building, also a Protestant church operated by a church in Korea. So it's always been very diverse. And even until recently, Antioch had this very famous multi-faith choir that was actually nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize a few years ago that incorporated people of many different faiths and sects that sang hymns from all the religions together and in different languages. So I think what made visiting Antakya special in the modern day was this sense of warmth and of welcoming and of diversity, which has just been a continuous feature. I mean, even today, Antakya, to the extent that it still remains, is a bilingual city. You know, people speak both Arabic and Turkish. And I think as far back as its original foundation, there's always been this babel of different languages in the streets. It's always been this crossing place on this trade route, the gateway to the Levant. And that I think was one of the most striking things, both in the research and in experiencing visiting the place myself, was the diversity.
Absolutely. And I believe there is some crumbs of comfort in terms of the Mosaic Museum in Antakya managed to survive the earthquake.
Yeah, indeed. So I think most of the treasures of the ancient world have been preserved still, because simply by virtue of the fact that they survived all the other earthquakes that have happened, the remnants of antiquity that survived the previous earthquakes survived this one as well. So, you know, Ottoman buildings, beautiful buildings built in the last 200-300 years, many of those did not survive, but the Roman and Greek mosaics did survive, Roman mosaics primarily, but Roman mosaics, I think, mainly have survived. The Iron Gate of Antioch survived. The Cave Church of St. Peter survived. So, but yes, the Greek Orthodox Church, more recently built, did not. And much of the old city did not. But everything that goes much further back, I think, did survive. Yeah.
Yeah. And though it's not easy, you can make arrangements to visit and put some money into the relief effort that way. I know you had contacts.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I would say I don't think it's still a time that people can visit for sort of tourism purposes.
Yeah,
because it's still very much a disaster zone. But I'd say soon it will be possible to visit again. But yeah, go yeah. But it's I don't. You know, it's certainly not ready to receive international visitors, generally speaking, yet. You know, when I went, it was very much you sleep in the car.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. So, because buildings.
That's a very interesting part of the book. And we talked about that in our previous episode. But we encourage people to contribute to the relief effort. Catherine, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I think anyone who's interested in Mediterranean history and travel will absolutely love it. It's covering the familiar and the unfamiliar for listeners of this podcast, and it's a really enjoyable read.
Thank you so much, Robin. It's been great to come on and discuss it with you. Thank you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.